God, raising his own hand to grip her wrist.
No.
Her voice was soft and throaty, blurred with the hint of an accent he could not place. He had never heard her speak before.
You're real? Yes.
Kassad sighed and looked around. He lay naked under a thin robe on some sort of couch or platform set in the middle of a dark, cavernous room. Overhead, starlight was visible through a broken roof. Kassad raised his other hand to touch her shoulder. Her hair was a dark nimbus above him. She wore a loose, thin gown which, even in the starlight, allowed him to see the outlines of her body. He caught her scent, the fragrant hint of soap and skin and her that he knew so well from their other times together.
You must have questions,
she whispered as Kassad released the gold clasp which held her gown in place. The gown whispered to the floor. She wore nothing underneath. Above them, the band of the Milky Way was clearly visible. No, said Kassad, and pulled her to him. Toward morning, a breeze arose, but Kassad pulled the light cover over them. The thin material seemed to preserve all of their body heat, and they lay together in perfect warmth. Somewhere, sand or snow rasped at bare walls. The stars were very clear and very bright. They awoke at the first hint of dawn, their faces close together under the silken coverlet. She ran her hand down Kassad's side, finding old and recent scars. Your name? Whispered Kassad.
Hush,
she whispered back, her hand sliding lower. Kassad moved his face into the scented curve of her neck. Her breasts were soft against him. Night paled to morning. Somewhere, sand or snow blew against bare walls. They made love, slept, made love again. In full light, they rose and dressed. She had laid out underwear, gray tunic, and trousers for Kassad. They fit perfectly, as did the sponge socks and soft boots. The woman wore a similar outfit of navy blue. Your name? Kassad asked, as they left the building with the shattered dome and walked through a dead city.
Moneta,
said his dream.
Or Nemosyne, whichever name pleases you more.
Moneta, whispered Kassad. He looked up at a small sun rising into a lapis sky. This is Hyperion?
Yes.
How did I land? Suspensor field? Parachute?
You descended under a wing of gold foil.
I don't hurt. There were no wounds?
They were tended to.
What is this place?
The city of poets, abandoned more than 100 years ago. Beyond that hill lie the time tombs.
The ouster assault boats that were following me.
One landed nearby. The Pain Lord took the crew unto himself. The other two set down some distance away.
Who is the Pain Lord?
Come,
said Moneta. The dead city ended in desert. Fine sand slid across white marble, half buried in dunes. To the west, an ouster dropship sat with its portals irised open. Nearby, on a fallen column, a therm cube yielded hot coffee and fresh-baked rolls. They ate and drank in silence. Kassad worked to recall the legends of Hyperion. The Pain Lord is the Shrike, he said at last.
Of course.
You're from here? From the City of Poets? Moneta smiled and slowly shook her head. Kassad finished his coffee and set the cup down. The feeling that he was in a dream persisted, much stronger than during any sim he had ever participated in. But the coffee had tasted pleasantly bitter. The sun was warm on his face and hands.
"Come, Kasad," said Moneta.
They crossed expanses of cold sand. Kasad found himself glancing skyward, knowing that the ouster torch ship could lance them from orbit. Then knowing, with a sudden certainty, that it would not. The time tombs lay in a valley. A low obelisk glowed softly. A stone sphinx seemed to absorb the light. A complex structure of twisted pylons threw shadows onto itself. Other tombs were silhouettes against the rising sun. Each of the tombs had a door, and each door was open. Kasad knew that they had been open when the first explorers discovered the tombs, and that the structures were empty. More than 3 centuries of searching for hidden rooms, tombs, vaults, and passageways had been fruitless.
"This is as far as you can go,"
Moneta said as they neared the cliff at the head of the valley.
"The time tides are strong today."
Kasad's tactical implant was silent. He had no comm log. He searched his memory. "There are anti-entropic force fields around the time tombs," he said.
"Yes."
"The tombs are ancient. The anti-entropic fields keep them from aging."
"No,"
said Moneta.
"The time tides drive the tombs backward through time."
"Backward through time," Kasad repeated stupidly.
"Look."
Shimmering, mirage-like, a tree of steel thorns appeared out of the haze, and a sudden dust storm of ochre sand. The thing seemed to fill the valley, rising at least 200 meters to the height of the cliffs. Branches shifted, dissolved, and reformed like elements of a poorly tuned hologram. Sunlight danced on 5-meter-long thorns. Corpses of ouster men and women, all naked, were impaled on at least a score of these thorns. Other branches held other bodies. Not all were human. The dust storm obscured the view for a moment, and when the wind subsided, the vision was gone.
"Come," said Moneta.
Kasad followed her through the fringes of the time tides, avoiding the ebb and flow of the anti-entropic field the way children would play tag with an ocean surf on a broad beach. Kasad felt the pull of the time tides like waves of deja vu tugging at every cell of his body. Just beyond the entrance to the valley, where hills opened to the dunes and low moors led to the city of poets, Moneta touched a wall of blue slate and an entrance opened to a long, low room set into the cliff face. "Is this where you live?" asked Kasad, but saw immediately that there were no signs of habitation. The stone walls of the room were inset with shelves and crowded niches.
"We must ready ourselves,"
whispered Moneta, and the lighting shifted to a golden hue. A long rack lowered its wares, a wafer-thin strip of reflective polymer curtained from the ceiling to serve as a mirror. Kasad watched with the calm passivity of a dreamer as Moneta stripped off her clothes and then his. Their nudity was no longer erotic, merely ceremonial. "You have been in my dreams for years," he told her.
"Yes, your past, my future. The shockwave of events moves across time like ripples on a pond."
Kasad blinked as she raised a gold ferrule and touched his chest. He felt a slight shock and his flesh became a mirror, his head and face a featureless ovoid reflecting all the color tones and textures of the room. A second later, Moneta joined him, her body becoming a cascade of reflections, water over quicksilver over chrome. Kasad saw his own reflecting reflection in every curve and muscle of her body. Moneta's breasts caught and bent the light. Her nipples rose like small splashes on a mirrored pond. Kasad moved to embrace her and felt their surfaces flow together like magnetized fluid. Under the connected fields, His flesh touched hers.
"Your enemies await beyond the city,"
she whispered. The chrome of her face flowed with light. Enemies.
"The ousters, the ones who followed you here."
Kassad shook his head, saw the reflection do likewise. "They're not important anymore."
"Oh, yes,"
whispered Moneta.
"The enemy is always important. You must arm yourself."
"With what?" But even as he spoke, Kassad realized that she was touching him with a bronze sphere, a dull blue toroid. His altered body spoke to him now as clearly as troops reporting in on an implant command circuit. Kassad felt the bloodlust build in him with turgid strength.
"Come."
Moneta led the way into an open desert again. The sunlight seemed polarized and heavy. Kassad felt that they were gliding across the dunes, flowing like liquid through the white marble streets of the dead city. Near the west end of town, near the shattered remnants of a structure still bearing the inscribed lintel of Poets' Amphitheater, something stood waiting. For a second, Kassad thought it was another person wearing the chromium force fields he and Moneta were draped in. But only for a second. There was nothing human about this particular quicksilver over chrome construct. Kassad dreamily noted the four arms, retractable finger blades, the profusion of thorn spikes on throat, forehead, wrists, knees, and body. But not once did his gaze leave the 2,000 faceted eyes, which burned with a red flame that paled sunlight and dimmed the day to blood shadows. "The Shrike," thought Kassad.
"The Lord of Pain,"
whispered Moneta. The thing turned and led them out of the dead city. Kassad approved of the way the ousters had prepared their defenses. The two assault boats were grounded less than half a kilometer apart, their guns, projectors, and missile turrets covering each other and a full 360 degrees of fire. Ouster ground troops had been busy digging revetments 100 meters out from the boats, and Kassad could see at least 2 EM tanks hull down, their projection arrays and launch tubes commanding the wide, empty moor between the Poet's City and the boats. Kassad's vision had been altered. He could see the overlapping ship containment fields as ribbons of yellow haze, the motion sensors and anti-personnel mines as eggs of pulsing red light. He blinked, realizing that something was wrong with the image. Then it came to him. Besides the thickness of the light and his enhanced perception of energy fields, nothing was moving. The ouster troops, even those set in attitudes of motion, were as stiff as the toy soldiers he had played with as a boy in the Tharsis slums. The EM tanks were dug into their hull-down positions, but Kassad noticed that now even their acquisition radars, visible to him as concentric purple arcs, were motionless. He glanced skyward and saw some sort of large bird hanging in the sky, as unmoving as an insect frozen in amber. He passed a cloud of wind-blown dust hanging suspended, extended one chrome hand, and flicked spirals of particles to the ground. Ahead of them, the Shrike strode casually through the red maze of sensor mines, stepped over the blue lines of trip beams, ducked under the violet pulses of the autofire scanners, passed through the yellow containment field and the green wall of the sonic defense perimeter, and walked into the assault boat's shadow. Moneta and Kassad followed. "How is this possible?" Kassad realized that he had posed the question through a medium that was something less than telepathy, but something far more sophisticated than implant conduction.
"He controls time."
"The Pain Lord?"
"Of course."
"Why are we here?" Moneta gestured toward the motionless ousters.
"They are your enemies."
Kassad felt that he was finally awaking from a long dream. This was real. The ouster trooper's eyes, unblinking behind his helmet, were real. The ouster assault boat, rising like a bronze tombstone to his left, was real. Fedmon Kassad realized that he could kill them all, commandos, assault boat crew, all of them, and they could do nothing about it. He knew that time had not stopped, any more than it stopped while a ship was under Hawking Drive. It was merely a matter of varying rates. The bird frozen above them would complete the flap of its wing given enough minutes or hours. The ouster in front of him would close his eyes in a blink if Kassad had the patience to watch long enough. Meanwhile, Kassad and Moneta and the Shrike could kill all of them without the ousters realizing that they were under attack. It was not fair, Kassad realized. It was wrong. It was the ultimate violation of the new Bushido. Worse in its way than the wanton murder of civilians. The essence of honor lay in the moment of combat between equals. He was about to communicate this to Moneta when she said,
Watch.
Time began again with an explosion of sound not unlike the rush of air into an airlock. The bird soared and circled overhead. A desert breeze threw dust against the static-charged containment field. An ouster commando rose from one knee, saw the Shrike and the two human shapes, screamed something over his tactical comm channel, and raised his energy weapon. The Shrike did not seem to move. To Kassad, it merely ceased being here and appeared there. The ouster commando emitted a second, shorter scream, and then looked down in disbelief as the Shrike's arm withdrew with the man's heart in its bladed fist. The ouster stared, opened his mouth as if to speak, and collapsed. Kassad turned to his right and found himself face to face with an armored ouster. The commando ponderously lifted a weapon. Kassad swung his arm, felt the chrome force field hum, and saw the flat of his hand cut through body armor, helmet, and neck. The ouster's head rolled in the dust. Kassad leaped into a low trench and saw several troopers begin to turn. Time was still out of joint. The enemy moved in extreme slow motion 1 second, jerked like a damaged hollow to 4/5 speed in the next instant. They were never as quick as Kassad. Gone were his thoughts of the new Bushido. These were the barbarians who had tried to kill him. He broke one man's back, stepped aside, jabbed rigid, chrome fingers through the body armor of a second man, crushed the larynx of a third, dodged a knife blade moving in slow motion, and kicked the spine out of the knife wielder. He leaped up out of the ditch.
Kassad!
Kassad ducked as the laser beam crept past his shoulder, burning its way through the air like a slow fuse of ruby light. Kassad smelled ozone as it crackled past.
Impossible. I've dodged a laser.
He picked up a stone and flung it at the ouster manning the tank-mounted hell whip. A sonic boom cracked. The gunner exploded backward. Kassad pulled a plasma grenade from a corpse's bandolier, leaped to the tank hatch, was 30 meters away before the explosion geysered flame as high as the assault boat's bow. Kassad paused in the eye of the storm to see Moneta in the center of her own circle of carnage. Blood splashed her, but did not adhere, flowing like oil on water across the rainbow curves of chin, shoulder, breast, and belly. She looked at him across the battlefield, and Kassad felt a renewed surge of bloodlust in himself. Behind her, the Shrike moved slowly through the chaos, choosing victims as if he were harvesting. Kassad watched the creature wink in and out of existence and realized that to the Lord of Pain, he and Moneta would appear to be moving as slowly as the ousters did to Kassad. Time jumped, moved to 4/5 speed. The surviving troops were panicking now, firing into one another, deserting their posts, and fighting to get aboard the assault boat. Kassad tried to realize what the past minute or two had been like for them. Blurs moving through their defensive positions, comrades dying in great gouts of blood. Kassad watched Moneta moving through their ranks, killing at her leisure. To his amazement, he discovered that he had some control of time. Blink and his opponents slowed to 1/3 speed. Blink and events moved at nearly their normal pace. Kassad's sense of honor and sanity called out for him to stop the slaughter, but his almost sexual bloodlust overpowered any objections. Someone in the assault boat had sealed the airlock, and now a terrified commando used a shaped plasma charge to blow the portal open. The mob pressed in, trampling the wounded in their flight from unseen killers. Kassad followed them in. The phrase, "fight like a cornered rat," is an extremely apt description. Throughout the history of military encounters, human combatants have been known to fight at their fiercest when challenged in enclosed places where flight is not an option. Whether in the passageways of La Haye Sainte and Hougoumont at Waterloo, or in the hive tunnels of Lussis, some of the most terrible hand-to-hand battles in history have been fought in cramped spaces where no retreat is possible. It was true this day. The ousters fought and died like cornered rats. The shrike had disabled the assault boat. Moneta remained outside to kill the 60 commandos who had stayed at their posts. Kassad killed those within. In the end, the final assault boat fired on its doomed counterpart. Kassad was outside by then, and he watched the particle beams and high-intensity lasers creep toward him, followed an eternity later by missiles which seemed to move so slowly that he could have written his name on them in flight. By that time, all of the ousters were dead in and around the overrun boat, but its containment field held. Energy dispersion and impact explosions tossed corpses around on the outer perimeter, set fire to equipment, and glazed the sand to glass. But Kassad and Moneta watched from inside a dome of orange flame as the remaining assault boat retreated to space.
"Can we stop them?"
Kassad was panting, pouring sweat, and literally quivering from excitement.
"We could," replied Moneta. "But we do not want to. They will carry the message to the swarm."
"What message?"
"Come here, Kassad."
He turned at the sound of her voice. The reflective force field was gone. Moneta's flesh was oiled with sweat. Her dark hair was matted against her temples. Her nipples were hard.
"Come here."
Kassad glanced down at himself. His own force field was gone. He had willed it away, and he was more sexually excited than he could ever remember being.
"Come here,"
Moneta whispered this time. Kassad went to her, lifted her, felt the sweat-slick smoothness of her buttocks as he carried her to an empty stretch of grass atop a wind-carved hummock. He lowered her to the ground between piles of ouster bodies, roughly opened her legs, took both her hands in the grasp of one of his, lifted her arms above her head, pinned them to the ground, and lowered his long body between her legs.
"Yes,"
whispered Moneta as he kissed the lobe of her left ear, set his lips to the pulse at the hollow of her neck, licked the salt tang sweat from her breasts. Lying among the dead, more dead to come, the thousands, the millions, laughter out of dead bellies, the long lines of troops emerging from jump ships to enter the waiting flames.
"Yes."
Her breath was hot in his ear. She freed her hands, slid them along Kassad's damp shoulders, trailed long nails down his back, grasped his buttocks to pull him closer. Kassad's erection scraped her pubic hair, throbbed against the cusp of her belly. Farcaster portals opening to admit the cold lengths of attack carriers, the warmth of plasma explosions, hundreds of ships, thousands dancing and dying like dust motes in a whirlwind. Great columns of solid ruby light lancing across great distances, bathing targets in the ultimate surge of warmth,
bodies boiling in red light.
Yes.
Moneta opened her mouth and body to him. Warmth above and below, her tongue in his mouth as he entered her, welcomed by warm friction. His body strained deep, pulled back slightly, allowed the moist warmth to engulf him further as they began to move together. Heat on 100 worlds, continents burning in bright spasms, the roll of boiling seas, the air itself aflame, oceans of superheated air swelling like warm skin rising to a lover's touch.
Yes, yes, yes.
Moneta breathes warm against his lips. Her skin is oil and velvet. Kassad thrusts quickly now, the universe contracting as sensation expands, senses dwindling as she closes warm and wet and tight around him. Her hips thrust harshly in response now, as if sensing the terrible build in pressure at the base of his being. Demanding. Kassad grimaces, closes his eyes, sees fireballs expanding, stars dying, suns exploding in great pulses of flame, star systems perishing in an ecstasy of destruction. He feels pain in his chest, his hips not stopping, moving faster, even as he opens his eyes and sees the great thorn of steel rising from between Moneta's breasts, almost impaling him as he unconsciously pulls up and back, the thorn blade drawing blood which drips on her flesh, her pale flesh, reflective now, flesh as cold as dead metal. His hips still moving, even as he watches through passion-dimmed eyes as Moneta's lips wither and curl back, revealing rows of steel blades where teeth had been. Metal blades slash at his buttocks where fingers had gripped. Legs, like powerful steel bands, imprison his pumping hips. Her eyes. In the last seconds before orgasm, Kassad tries to pull away. His hands on her throat, pressing. She clings like a leech, a lamprey ready to drain him. They roll against dead bodies. Her eyes, like red jewels, blazing with a mad heat like that which fills his aching testicles, expanding like a flame, spilling over. Kassad slams both hands against the soil, lifts himself away from her, from it. His strength insane, but not enough, as terrible gravities press them together. Sucking like a lamprey's mouth as he threatens to explode, looks in her eyes. The death of worlds. The death of worlds. Kassad screams and pulls away. Strips of his flesh rip away as he lunges up and sideways. Metal teeth click shut in a steel vagina, missing his glands by a moist millimeter. Kassad slumps on his side, rolls away, hips moving, unable to stop his ejaculation. Semen explodes in streams, falls on the curled fist of a corpse. Kassad moans, rolls again, curls in a fetal position even as he comes again and again. He hears the hiss and rustle as she rises behind him. Kassad rolls on his back and squints up against the sunlight and his own pain. She stands above him, legs apart, a silhouette of thorns. Kassad wipes sweat from his eyes, sees his wrist come away red with blood, and waits for the killing blow. His skin contracts in anticipation of the slash of blade into flesh. Panting, Kassad looks up to see Moneta above him, thighs flesh rather than steel, her groin matted from the moisture of their passion. Her face is dark, the sun behind her, but he sees red flames dying in the multifaceted pits of her eyes. She smiles, and he sees sunlight glint on rows of metal teeth.
Kassad,
she whispers, and it is the sound of sand scraping against bone. Kassad tears his gaze away, struggles to his feet, and stumbles across corpses and burning rubble in his terror to be free. He does not look back. Scouting elements of Hyperion's self-defense force found Colonel Fedmon Kassad almost 2 days later. He was discovered lying unconscious on one of the grassy moors which led to the abandoned Kronos Keep, some 20 kilometers from the dead city and the wreckage of the ouster ejection pod. Kassad was naked and almost dead from the effects of exposure and several serious wounds. But he responded well to emergency field treatment and was immediately airlifted south of the Bridal Range to a hospital at Keats. Reconnaissance squads from the SDF battalion moved northward carefully, cautious of the anti-entropic tides around the time tombs and wary of any booby traps left behind by the ousters. There were none. The scouts found only the wreckage of Kassad's escape mechanism and the burned-out hulks of the two assault boats, which the ousters had lanced from orbit. There were no clues as to why they had slagged their own ships, and the ouster bodies, both in and around the boats, had been burned beyond any hope of autopsy or analysis. Kassad regained consciousness 3 Hyperion days later, swore that he remembered nothing after stealing the squid, and was shipped out on a force torch ship 2 local weeks later. Upon returning to the web, Kassad resigned his commission. For a while, he was active in anti-war movements, occasionally appearing on the All Thing Net, arguing disarmament. But the attack on Brescia had mobilized the hegemony toward true interstellar war, as had nothing else in 3 centuries. And Kassad's voice was either drowned out or dismissed as the guilty conscience of the butcher of South Brescia. In the 16 years after Brescia, Colonel Kassad had disappeared from the web and from the web consciousness. Although there had been no more major battles, the ousters remained the hegemony's prime boogeymen. Fedmon Kassad was only a fading memory.
It was late morning when Kassad finished his story. The consul blinked and looked around him, noticing the ship and its surroundings for the first time in more than 2 hours. The Benares had come out into the main channel of the Huli. The consul could hear the creaks of the chains and hawsers as the river mantas surged against their harnesses. The Benares appeared to be the only ship heading upriver, but now numerous small craft were visible going the other way. The consul rubbed his forehead and was surprised to see his hand come away slick with sweat. The day had grown very warm, and the shadow of the tarp had crept away from the consul without his noticing. He blinked, wiped sweat from his eyes, and moved into the shade to get a drink from one of the liquor bottles the androids had set in a cabinet near the table. "My God," Father Hoyt was saying. "So, according to this Moneta creature, the time tombs are moving backward in time?"
"Yes,"
said Kassad. "Is that possible?" asked Hoyt.
"Yes."
It was Saul Weintraub who answered.
"If that's true, then you met this Moneta, or whatever her real name is, in her past but your future, in a meeting that's still to come."
"Yes,"
said Kassad. Martin Silenus walked to the railing and spat into the river.
"Colonel, do you think the bitch was the Shrike?"
"I don't know."
Kassad's monotone was barely audible. Silenus turned to Saul Weintraub.
"You're a scholar. Is there anything in the Shrike mythography that says the thing can change shape?"
"No,"
said Weintraub. He was preparing a milk globe to feed his daughter. The infant made soft, mewling noises and moved tiny fingers.
"Colonel,"
said Het Mastin,
"the force field, whatever the fighting suit was, did you bring it with you after the encounter with the ousters and this female?"
Kassad looked at the Templar a moment and then shook his head. The consul was staring into his drink, but his head suddenly snapped upright with the force of a thought.
"Colonel, you said that you saw a vision of the Shrike's killing tree, the structure, the thing where it impales its victims."
Kassad moved his basilisk stare from the Templar to the consul. He slowly nodded.
And there were bodies on it.
Another nod. The consul wiped sweat from his upper lip.
If the tree is traveling backward in time with the time tombs, then the victims are from our future.
Kassad said nothing. The others also were staring at the consul now, but only Weintraub appeared to understand what the comment meant, and what the consul's next question had to be. The consul resisted the urge to wipe the sweat from his lip again. His voice was steady.
Did you see any of us there?
Kassad said nothing for more than a minute. The soft sounds of the river and the ship's rigging suddenly seemed very loud. Finally, Kassad took a breath.
Yes.
Silence stretched again. Braun Lamia broke it.
Will you tell us who?
No.
Kassad rose and went to the stairway leading to the lower decks. Wait, called Father Hoyt. Kassad paused at the head of the stairway. Will you at least tell us two other things?
What?
Father Hoyt grimaced from a wave of pain. His gaunt face went white under its film of perspiration. He took a breath and said, First, do you think the Shrike, the woman, somehow wants to use you to start this terrible interstellar war you foresaw?
Yes.
Second, will you tell us what you plan to petition the Shrike for, or this Moneta, when you meet them on the pilgrimage? Kassad smiled for the first time. It was a thin smile, and very, very cold.
I will make no petition. I will ask nothing of them. When I meet them this time, I will kill them.
The other pilgrims did not speak or look at one another as Kassad went below. The Benares continued north-northeast into afternoon. 3. The barge Benares entered the river port of Naiad an hour before sunset. Crew and pilgrims pressed to the rail to stare at smoldering embers of what once had been a city of 20,000 people. Little remained. The famous Riverfront Inn, built in the days of Sad King Billy, had burned to the foundations. Its charred docks, piers, and screened balconies now collapsed into the shallows of the Hooghly. The custom house was a burned-out shell. The airship terminal on the north end of town survived only as a blackened hulk, its mooring tower reduced to a spire of charcoal. There was no sign whatsoever of the small riverfront Shrike temple. Worst of all, from the pilgrims' point of view, was the destruction of the Naiad River Station. The harness dock lay burned and sagging, the manta holding pens open to the river.
God damn it!
Said Martin Silenus.
Who did it? Asked Father Hoyt. The Shrike?
More likely the SDF, said the consul, although they may have been fighting the Shrike.
I can't believe this,
snapped Braun Lamia. She turned to A. Bettick, who had just joined them on the rear deck.
Didn't you know this had happened?
No,
said the android.
There has been no contact with any point north of the locks for more than a week.
Why the hell not? Even if this godforsaken world doesn't have a datasphere, don't you have a radio?
A. Bettick smiled slightly.
Yes, M. Lamia, there is radio, but the commsats are down. The microwave repeater stations at the Kala locks were destroyed, and we have no access to shortwave.
What about the mantas?
Asked Kassad.
Can we press on to the edge with the ones we have?
Bettick frowned.
We will have to, Colonel. But it is a crime. The two in harness will not recover from such a pull. With fresh mantas, we would have put into edge before dawn. With these two...
The android shrugged.
With luck, if the beasts survive, We will arrive by early afternoon.
The wind wagon will still be there, will it not?
Asked Het Mastin.
We must assume so,
said A. Betek.
If you will excuse me, I will see to feeding the poor beasts we have. We should be underway again within the hour.
They saw no one in or near the ruins of Naiad. No river craft made their appearance above the city. An hour's pull northeast of the town, they entered the region where the forests and farms of the lower Huli gave way to the undulating orange prairie south of the Sea of Grass. Occasionally, the consul would see the mud towers of architect ants, some of their serrated structures near the river reaching almost 10 meters in height. There was no sign of intact human habitation. The ferry at Betty's Ford was totally gone, with not even a tow rope or warming shack left to show where it had stood for almost 2 centuries. The River Runners Inn at Cave Point was dark and silent. A. Betek and other crew members hallooed, but there was no response from the black cave mouth. Sunset brought a sensuous stillness over the river, soon broken by a chorus of insect noises and nightbird calls. For a while, the surface of the Huli became a mirror of the gray-green disk of twilight sky, disturbed only by the leap of dusk-feeding fish and the wake of the laboring mantis. As true darkness fell, innumerable prairie gossamers, much paler than their forest cousins, but also of greater wingspan, luminescent shades the size of small children, danced in the vales and valleys of the gently rolling hills. By the time the constellations emerged and the meteor trails began scarring the night sky, a brilliant display this far from all man-made light. The lanterns had been lit and dinner set out on the aft deck. The Shrike pilgrims were subdued, as if still contemplating Colonel Kassad's grim and confusing tale. The consul had been drinking steadily since before midday, and now he felt the pleasant displacement from reality, from the pain of memory, which allowed him to get through each day and night. Now he asked, his voice as careful and unslurred as only a true alcoholic's can be, whose turn it was to tell a tale.
Mine,
said Martin Silenus. The poet also had been drinking steadily since early in the day. His voice was as carefully controlled as the consul's, but redness on his sharp cheeks and an almost manic brightness of eye gave the old poet away.
At least I drew number 3.
He held up his slip of paper.
If you still want to hear the fucking thing.
Brawn Lamia lifted her glass of wine, scowled, and set it down.
Perhaps we should talk about what we have learned from the first 2 stories and how it might relate to our current situation.
Not yet, said Colonel Kassad. We don't have enough information.
Let M. Silenus speak, said Saul Weintraub. Then we can begin discussing what we have heard.
I agree, said Lenar Hoyt.
Het Mastin and the consul nodded.
Agreed. I'll tell my story. Just let me finish my fucking glass of wine. The Poet's Tale, Hyperion Kantos. In the beginning was the word. Then came the fucking word processor. Then came the thought processor. Then came the death of literature, and so it goes. Francis Bacon once said, "There arises from a bad and unapt formation of words a wonderful obstruction to the mind." We have all contributed our wonderful obstructions to the mind, have we not? I, more than most. One of the 20th century's better forgotten writers, that is, better comma forgotten, once bon mode, "I love being a writer. It's the paperwork I can't stand." Get it? Well, amigos and amiguette, I love being a poet. It's the goddamn words I can't stand. Where to start? Start with Hyperion, perhaps. Fade in. Almost 2 standard centuries ago. Sad King Billy's 5 seed ships spin like gold dandelions above this all-too-familiar lapis sky. We land like conquistadors strutting to and fro. More than 2,000 visual artists and writers and sculptors and poets and arnists and vid-makers and holly directors and composers and decomposers and God knows what all, supported by 5 times that many administrators and technicians and ecologists and supervisors and court chamberlains and professional ass-kissers, not to mention the family of royal asses themselves, supported in turn by 10 times that many androids willing to till the soil and stoke the reactors and raise the cities and lift that bale and tote that load. Hell, you get the idea. We landed on a world already seated by the poor buggers who'd gone indigene 2 centuries before, and were living hand to mouth and cudgel to brain wherever they could. Naturally, the noble descendants of these brave pioneers greeted us like gods, especially after a few of our security folk slagged a few of their more aggressive leaders. And naturally, we accepted their worship as our due and put them to work next to our blueskins, plowing the South 40 and working to build our shining city on the hill. And it was a shining city on a hill. Seeing the ruins today can tell you nothing of the place. The desert has advanced in 3 centuries. The aqueducts from the mountains have fallen and shattered. The city itself is only bones. But in its day, the city of poets was fair indeed. A bit of Socrates' Athens with the intellectual excitement of Renaissance Venice, the artistic fervor of Paris and the days of the Impressionists, the true democracy of the first decade of Orbit City, and the unlimited future of Tau Ceti Center. But in the end, it was none of these things, of course. It was only Hrothgar's claustrophobic Mead Hall with the monster waiting in the darkness without. We had our Grendel, to be sure. We even had our Hrothgar, if one squints a bit at Sad King Billy's poor slouched profile. We lacked only our Geats, our great, broad-shouldered, small-brained Beowulf with his band of merry psychopaths. So lacking a hero, we settled into the role of victims, and composed our sonnets and rehearsed our ballets and unrolled our scrolls, while all the while our thorn and steel Grendel served the night with fear and harvested thigh bones and gristle. And this was when I, a satyr then, formed in flesh as mirror to my soul, came as close to completing my kantos, my life's work, as I have come in 5 sad centuries of stubborn continuance. Fade to black. It occurs to me that the Grendel tale is premature. The players have not been brought upon the stage. Dislinear plotting and non-contiguous prose have their adherents, not the least of which am I. But in the end, my friends, it is character which wins or loses immortality upon the vellum. Haven't you ever harbored the secret thought that somewhere Huck and Jim are at this instant poling their raft down some river just beyond our reach? So much more real are they than the shoe clerk who fitted us just a forgotten day ago. At any rate, if this fucking story's to be told, you should know who's in it. So, as much as it pains me, I'll back up to begin at the beginning. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was programmed in classic binary. And the Word said, "Let there be life." And so, somewhere in the Technocore vaults of my mother's estate, frozen sperm from my long-dead daddy was defrosted, set in suspension, shaken like the vanilla malts of yore, loaded into something part squirt gun, part dildo, and at the magic touch of a trigger, ejaculated into mother at a time when the moon was full and the egg was ripe. Mother didn't have to be impregnated in this barbaric fashion, of course. She could have chosen ex-utero fertilization, a male lover with a transplant of daddy's DNA, a clonal surrogate, a gene-spliced virgin birth, you name it. But as she told me later, she opened her legs to tradition. My guess is that she preferred it that way. Anyway, I was born. I was born on Earth. Old Earth. And fuck you, Lamia, if you don't believe it. We lived on Mother's estate on an island not far from the North American Preserve. Notes for Sketch of Home on Old Earth. Fragile twilights fading from violet to fuchsia to purple above the crepe paper silhouettes of trees beyond the southwest sweep of lawn. Skies as delicate as translucent china, unscarred by cloud or contrail. The pre-symphony hush of first light, followed by the cymbal crash of sunrise. Oranges and russets igniting to gold. The long, cool descent to green. Leaf shadow, shade, tendrils of cypress, weeping willow. The hushed green velvet of the glade. Mother's estate. Our estate. 1,000 acres, centered in a million more. Lawns the size of small prairies, with grass so perfect, it beckoned a body to lie on it, to nap on its soft perfection. Noble shade trees making sundials of the earth, their shadows circling in stately procession, now mingling, now contracting to midday, finally stretching eastward with the dying of the day. Royal oak, giant elms, cottonwood and cypress and redwood and bonsai, banyan trees, lowering new trunks like smooth-sided columns in a temple roofed by sky. Willows lining carefully laid canals and haphazard streams, their hanging branches singing ancient dirges to the wind. Our house rises on a low hill, where in the winter the browning curves of lawn look like the smooth flank of some female beast, all thigh muscle and meant for speed. The house shows its centuries of accretion, a jade tower on the east courtyard catching the first light of dawn, a series of gables on the south wing throwing triangles of shadow on the crystal conservatory at tea time. The balconies and maze of exterior stairways along the east porticos playing Escher games with afternoon's shadows. It was after the big mistake, but before everything grew uninhabitable. Mostly, we occupied the estate during what we quaintly called periods of remission. Stretches of 10 to 18 quiet months between planet-wide spasms as the Kiev team's goddamn little black hole digested bits of the Earth's center and waited for its next feast. During the bad times, we vacationed at Uncle Koa's place out beyond the moon, on a terraformed asteroid brought there before the ouster migration. You might already be able to tell that I was born with a silver spoon up my ass. I offer no apologies. After 3,000 years of dabbling with democracy, the remaining old Earth families had come to the realization that the only way to avoid such riffraff was not to allow them to breed, or rather, to sponsor seedship fleets. spinship explorations, new Farcaster migrations, all of the panicked urgency of the Hajira, as long as they bred out there and left old Earth alone. The fact that the home world was a diseased old bitch, gone in the teeth, didn't hurt the riffraff's urge to pioneer. No fools they. And like the Buddha, I was almost grown before I saw my first hint of poverty. I was 16 standard years old, on my Vandayar, and backpacking through India, when I saw a beggar. The Hindu old families kept them around for religious reasons, but all I knew at the time was that here was a man in rags, ribs showing, holding out a wicker basket with an ancient credit disky in it, begging for a touch of my universal card. My friends thought it was hysterical. I threw up. It was in Benares. My childhood was privileged, but not obnoxiously so. I have pleasant memories of Grandam Sybil's famous parties. She was a great aunt on my mother's side. I remember one three-day affair she threw in the Manhattan Archipelago. Guests ferried in by dropship from Orbit City, from the European arcologies. I remember the Empire State Building rising from the water, its many lights reflecting on the lagoons and fern canals, the EMVs unloading passengers on the observation deck, while cooking fires burned on the overgrown island mounds of lower buildings all around. The North American Preserve was our private playground in those days. It was said that about 8,000 people still resided in that mysterious continent, but half of these were rangers. The rest included the renegade Arnists, who plied their trade by resurrecting species of plants and animals long absent from their antediluvian North American haunts. The ecology engineers, licensed primitives such as the Ogallala Sioux or the Hell's Angel Guild, and the occasional tourist. I had a cousin who reportedly backpacked from one observation zone to the other in the preserve, but he did so in the Midwest, where the zones were relatively close together and where the dinosaur herds were much scarcer. In the first century, after the big mistake, Gaia was mortally injured, but slow in the dying. The devastation was great during the bad times, and these came more often in precisely plotted spasms, shorter remissions, more terrible consequences after each attack. But the Earth abided and repaired itself as best it could. The preserve was, as I say, our playground, but in a real sense, so was all of the dying Earth. Mother let me have my own EMV when I was 7, and there was no place on the globe farther than an hour's flight from home. My best friend, Amalfi Schwartz, lived in the Mount Erebus Estates in what had once been the Antarctic Republic. We saw each other daily. The fact that old Earth law forbade Farcasters did not bother us in the least. Lying on some hillside at night, looking up through the 10,000 orbiting lights and the 20,000 beacons of the ring, at the 2,000 or 3,000 visible stars, we felt no jealousy, no urge to join the Hajira, that even then was spinning the Farcaster's silk of the world web. We were happy. My memories of Mother are oddly stylized, as if she were another fictional construct from one of my Dying Earth novels. Perhaps she was. Perhaps I was raised by robots in the automated cities of Europe, suckled by androids in the Amazon desert, or simply grown in a vat like brewer's yeast. What I recall is Mother's white gown, sliding ghost-like through the shadowed rooms of the estate, infinitely delicate blue veins on the back of her thin-fingered hand, as she poured tea in the damask and dust light of the conservatory. Candlelight caught like a gold fly in the spider-web sheen of her hair, hair done up in a bun in the style of the grand dames. Sometimes I dream that I remember her voice, the lilt and tone and turn in the womb centeredness of it. But then I awake, and it becomes only the wind moving lace curtains or the sound of some alien sea on stone. From my earliest sense of self, I knew that I would be, should be, a poet. It was not as if I had a choice, more like the dying beauty all about breathed its last breath in me and commanded that I be doomed to play with words the rest of my days, as if in expiation for our race's thoughtless slaughter of its crib world. So what the hell? I became a poet. I had a tutor whose name was Balthazar, human but ancient, a refugee from ancient Alexandria's flesh-scented alleys. Balthazar all but glowed blue-white from those crude, early Poulsen treatments. He was like an irradiated mummy of a man, sealed in liquid plastic, and randy as the proverbial goat. Centuries later, when I was in my satyr period, I felt that I finally understood poor Don Balthazar's priapic compulsions. But in those days it was mostly a hindrance to keeping young girls on the estate staff. Human or android, Don Balthazar did not discriminate. He poinked them all. Luckily for my education, there was nothing homosexual in Don Balthazar's addiction to young flesh, so his escapades evidenced themselves either as absences from our tutorial sessions or an inordinate amount of attention lavished on memorizing verses from Ovid, Senish, or Wu. He was an excellent tutor. We studied the ancients and the late classical period, took field trips to the ruins of Athens, Rome, London, and Hannibal, Missouri, and never once had a quiz or test. Don Balthazar expected me to learn everything by heart at first encounter, and I did not disappoint him. He convinced my mother that the pitfalls of progressive education were not for an old earth family. So I never knew the mind-stunting shortcuts of RNA medication, datasphere immersion, systemic flashback training, stylized encounter groups, higher-level thinking skills at the expense of facts, or preliterate programming. As a result of these deprivations, I was able to recite all of Fitzgerald's translation of the Odyssey by the time I was 6, compose a sestina before I could dress myself, and think in spiral fugue verse before I ever interfaced with an AI. My scientific education, on the other hand, was something less than stringent. Don Balthazar had little interest in what he referred to as the mechanical side of the universe. I was 22 before I realized that computers, RMUs, and Uncle Koa's asteroidal life support devices were machines, and not some benevolent manifestations of the animus around us. I believed in fairies, wood sprites, numerology, astrology, and the magic of Midsummer's Eve deep in the primitive forests of the NAP. Like Keats and Lamb in Hayden's studio, Don Balthazar and I drank toasts to the confusion of mathematics and mourned the destruction of the poetry of the rainbow by M. Newton's prying prism. The early distrust and actual hatred of all things scientific and clinical served me well in later life. It is not difficult, I have learned, to remain a pre-Copernican pagan in the post-scientific hegemony. My early poetry was execrable. As with most bad poets, I was unaware of this fact, secure in my arrogance that the very act of creating gave some worth to the worthless abortions I was spawning. My mother remained tolerant even as I left reeking little piles of doggerel lying around the house. She was indulgent of her only child, even if he was as blithely incontinent as an unhousebroken llama. Don Balthazar never commented on my work, primarily, I assume, because I never showed him any of it. Don Balthazar thought that the venerable Dayton was a fraud, that Salmid Brevi and Robert Frost should have hanged themselves with their own entrails, that Wordsworth was a fool, and that anything less than Shakespeare's sonnets was a profanation of the language. I saw no reason to bother Don Balthazar with my verse, rife with budding genius, though I knew it to be. I published several of these little literary turds in the various hard-copy journals then in vogue in the various arcologies of the European houses, the amateur editors of these crude journals being as indulgent of my mother as she was of me. Occasionally, I would press Amalfi or one of my other playmates, less aristocratic than I, and thus with access to the datasphere or fatline transmitters, to uplink some of my verses to the Ring or to Mars, and thus to the burgeoning Farcaster colonies. They never replied. I assumed they were too busy. Belief in one's identity as a poet or writer prior to the acid test of publication is as naive and harmless as the youthful belief in one's immortality. And the inevitable disillusionment is just as painful. My mother died with old Earth. About half the old families stayed during that last cataclysm. I was 20 years old then, and had made my own romantic plans to die with the homeworld. Mother decided otherwise. What concerned her was not my premature demise. Like me, she was far too self-centered to think of someone else at a time like that. Nor even the fact that the death of my DNA would mark the end of a line of aristocrats which stretched back to the Mayflower. No, what bothered Mother was that the family was going to die out in debt. Our last 100 years of extravagance, it seems, had been financed through massive loans from the Ring Bank and other discreet extraterrestrial institutions. Now that the continents of Earth were crashing under the impact of contraction, the great forests aflame, the oceans heaving and heating themselves into a lifeless soup, the very air transforming itself into something too hot and thick to break and too thin to plow, now the banks wanted their money back. I was collateral, or rather Mother's plan was. She liquidated all available assets some weeks before that phrase became a literal reality, deposited $250,000 in long-term accounts in the fleeing Ring Bank, and dispatched me on a trip to the Rifkin Atmospheric Protectorate on Heaven's Gate, a minor world circling the star Vega. Even then, that poisonous world had a Farcaster connection to Sol System, but I did not Farcast, nor was I a passenger on the single spin ship with Hawking Drive, which put into Heaven's Gate each standard year. No, Mother sent me to this back end of the outback on a Phase 3 ram ship,